Lecture 12, Diderot's Dialogues.
In Boswell's diary, we met a somewhat naive but very fresh and believable picture of a gap between available models of the self and a real person's own conflicted experience. And we saw how words like sentiment and sensibility were having to mutate to express new ways of understanding. Now we turn to a very different kind of writer at exactly the same time, a leading figure in the French Enlightenment who uses the dialogue form to explore the complexity of psychological experience and to concentrate on the self in its social context, giving us not a single perspective as Boswell does, but the multiple perspectives that an accomplished fiction writer can create. This is Denis Diderot. He was born in 1713. That's a generation later than Voltaire, the same generation as Johnson and Hume. He was born in one of the eastern provinces of France, not an aristocrat, the son of a master cutler, that is, an expert maker of knives, and all his life he retained a keen interest in the trades and practical technology. Since he was an exceptionally bright boy, his family expected him to go into the church, as indeed one of his brothers did. But he disliked it intensely, so he went to Paris and became a student there, and started to make his living with miscellaneous writing of various kinds. Before we turn to the works that will concern us in this course, works that he never published because of their potentially controversial implications, I need to sketch for you his role in the public campaign of the Enlightenment. And that was to give fully 15 years of his life as editor-in-chief of a monumental undertaking, and that was the Great Encyclopedia of the Sciences, Arts, and Trades, which began to appear in 1751 and in the end filled 17 huge folio-sized volumes. It was immensely recognized as enormously important, and ever since then it's been seen as the central work of the Enlightenment. And it's very relevant that it was a collective undertaking. The idea was to gather authoritative articles on every subject a reader might want to know about. The preliminary discourse of the encyclopedia was written very brilliantly and quickly became famous by Jean d'Alembert, whom we'll meet shortly in one of Diderot's dialogues. D'Alembert was a mathematician. He stressed the familiar Enlightenment theme of the interconnection of the sciences and shared research programs. And the goal was to gather all of human knowledge, but with particular emphasis on practical technology, which up until then had been protected as the insider knowledge of particular crafts and guilds. And for this reason, the encyclopedia includes several volumes of highly detailed, beautiful engravings that show how to dye cloth and make a spinning machine and so forth. D'Alembert was supposed to be the co-editor, but in fact the bulk of the work was done by Diderot himself. Diderot was a true polymath. He loved all kinds of knowledge, and among other things he was a pioneer philosopher of science, especially the life sciences, which were beginning to replace physics, much as happened again during the 20th century, at the center of scientific inquiry. Diderot belonged to the very last generation for whom science and philosophy were still one and the same. There are two essential points I want to make about the encyclopedia. First, it treats knowledge as interrelated, but not hierarchical. And that's completely different from the older encyclopedias going back to the Middle Ages, where theology was called the queen of the sciences and came first and controlled everything else. Now, of course, it's the format we all take for granted today, the only arrangement is alphabetical, which implies that knowledge is empirical. It's based on accumulated experience. It's not organized in a systematic way because systems change. I remember looking once at the original English Encyclopedia Britannica, which was a sort of small-scale imitation of the French encyclopedia, and I had some reason to look up the entry for God, and I noted it came right after the entry for glue. So it's simply working your way through the alphabet. And that's my first point about the encyclopedia, its commitment to an ideal of factual objectivity, which is arranged for easy retrieval of information. I'm sure Diderot would have thought our modern internet search engines were the perfect fulfillment of his goal. The second point is quite different. The philosophe of the Enlightenment may have thought their program was totally objective, but in actuality it was driven by a highly ideological motive. They are committed to an ideology of progress in what has often been called a religion of humanity. Knowledge wasn't just an end in itself. It was meant to be instrumental to help us improve our world, conquer disease, put politics on a better footing, in general, improve every aspect of human life. And this religion of humanity could well find itself in conflict, and did, with the entrenched religious and political systems of Europe. Diderot himself experienced that firsthand. Very early in his career, in 1749, he was imprisoned for several months, admittedly in an extremely pleasant chateau, because he had published a book with, you would think, the innocuous title, A Letter on the Blind. And what he did was follow empiricist logic to raise the subversive possibility that if someone was born blind, that is lacking a major part of the sensory input, which according to empiricism is our only source of knowledge, then that person might not at all form the moral, or you might say religious, assumptions that religious teachings still said were inborn in us all. And the church authorities noticed this, banned the book, put the guy in prison, and let him out only on the strength of a solemn promise to never publish anything ever again that might be contrary to religion and morals. And he kept that promise. It wasn't a sellout. He had to. His larger mission of promoting Enlightenment progress would have been thwarted if he hadn't. But as it turned out, it liberated him to be much freer and more exploratory than he otherwise could have been in the unpublished works that he went on adding to and revising for years. And that's exactly what did happen with the ones that we'll turn to now. Let's start with the shortest of them, D'Alembert's Dream, which is preceded by a very brief conversation between D'Alembert and Diderot. He began it sometime in the 1760s. It wasn't published till 1782, and then only in a very limited circulation form. The larger public never saw it until half a century after Diderot's death. In the conversation, D'Alembert is made to take the standard empiricist line that personal existence is based on memory. If we couldn't connect up all the bits of data from our past experiences, we wouldn't have a self. Diderot, however, is interested in the subrational, or non-conscious connections that we share with all other living organisms. And so in the longer work that follows the little conversation, the work called D'Alembert's Dream, he imagines his friend, the mathematician, sound asleep and talking in his sleep. And there are two friends there with him. His doctor's name is Bourdieu, and his mistress, Mlle de l'Espinasse. And the two of them carry on a rambling, freewheeling discussion about the mysteriousness of life. What Diderot is concerned with, fundamentally, is the then shocking philosophy of materialism, which held that nothing exists in the universe except matter. That was implicit 100 years before with Hobbes and others, but for them, the model was mathematical physics, which made it seem sort of abstract and not so threatening. The new 18th century materialism was very threatening to traditional thought, because it focused on matter as the sole basis of all living forms. There's no spirit, no soul, not even any mind, except as a phenomenon of brain chemistry. Of course, that's an issue still being debated to this very day. And the most dangerous claim in Diderot's Letter on the Blind was denying the existence of a perfect order that had continued without alteration since God first established it. The religious position was, no species has ever changed since the creation of the world. And no new species has ever been added. And all species are linked in a great chain that includes every possible form from lowest to highest. But what people were beginning to envision by the middle of the 18th century was the possibility of evolution. It would be 100 years before Darwin would give evolution a secure conceptual basis with his theory of natural selection. But the idea of evolution itself was very much in circulation by Diderot's time, and he personally was extremely interested in it. You can see what this might imply for thinking about the self. Human beings are not special and unique. They're not distinguished from all other life forms by their ability to think. On the contrary, as the logic of empiricism would suggest, human beings are instinctual organisms just as much as mice are or worms are. And whatever holds us together as individuals must be a system of programmed behaviors, not a personal self that we construct out of specific data of our own memory experiences. And it follows, too, that the evolutionary process is still continuing. Hume said the self is a flux. Now all of nature is imagined in flux, not just a few species that never changed, but a continual variation and transformation. Also, by introducing Mlle de Lespinasse into the dialogue, Diderot makes an important point about gender. It was still common to think of men and women as fundamentally different, which, of course, helped to justify different social relationships. But according to the new biology, which Diderot is so interested in, the only difference really is the sexual organs, and even those differentiated from a common origin during fetal development. They knew that then. So his conclusion is a very radical one for the time. Men and women are fundamentally the same, and therefore equal. For Diderot, then, our unity of selves has nothing to do with conscious thought. And as to prove the point in his dialogue, he makes D'Alembert keep tossing in his sleep and uttering incoherent remarks, but interesting ones. Now, you remember Locke said someone asleep is literally not the same person as when they're awake. But Dr. Bourdieu and Mlle de Lespinasse, who know D'Alembert well, can tell perfectly well it's him, though when he's dreaming, he lets himself go and thinks a lot more imaginatively than he does when he's awake. Now for the longer work I want to take up in this lecture, Rameau's nephew. Like D'Alembert's dream, it too was begun in the 1760s and added to for many years. It remained virtually unknown among Diderot's papers until finally, long after his death, it was published. A really reliable manuscript didn't surface till 1891. In this work, Diderot imagines himself at a café, which you might say is a kind of new place for intellectual exchange at the time, replacing those fashionable aristocratic salons. And there he falls into conversation with a journeyman musician he happens to know called Jean-François Rameau. And this guy is a nephew of a very great composer, Jean-Philippe Rameau, but the nephew makes a very ignoble living as a parasite on wealthy patrons. Now, in fact, both speakers in this dialogue are clearly aspects of Diderot himself. And he calls one the moi, the me, who is made to express the ideal of a coherent, stable character and coherent moral values, which the philosophe Diderot is hoping to have achieved through experience that gives him wisdom. The other speaker, the ne'er-do-well Rameau, is the lui, the he. So it's me and he in conversation. And this Rameau is very well aware he's far inferior to his uncle, the great musician, but he's also aware his uncle is a mean, selfish person because genius doesn't necessarily go along with good human qualities. And he argues a profoundly cynical view of life. According to Rameau, the nephew, all of us are putting on an act all the time, and at least he is honest enough to admit it, which he says the moi character, speaking for Diderot, does not. It's notable that all of these unpublished works of Diderot's are extremely open-ended. Someone called him once an uncompleting man. He's an initiator, not a concluder. And in a way, that too fits the spirit of empiricism, which is all about provisional guesses that give way to others when more evidence comes in. So, dividing himself into two different speakers in a dialogue is a way of recognizing multiple perspectives. I think it's a literary form that actually expresses the Humean self better than Hume's own systematic exposition does, and uncompletedness is the message. It begins with a quote from the Roman poet Horace. And this is a dialogue between Horace and his slave, which takes place on the Saturnalia. That was a festival every year when the slaves would get to speak their mind. And so this one accuses Horace of himself being a slave, of the people he always wants to impress. And the slave says, "You're moved like a wooden puppet by wires that other people pull." That quote from Horace gives the central theme of Diderot's dialogue, which is why he put it at the beginning. We're all puppets. We like to think we're free, but really we respond very predictably to outside stimuli. Not surprisingly, Diderot's materialism included the determinism that we talked about in connection with Hobbes and Hume, and that's something we'll discuss more in the next two lectures when we take up Diderot's novel, Jacques the Fatalist, whose title contains the idea. The very first paragraph of Rameau's Nephew is an engaging account of the mind as a scene of playfulness and whim. It's my custom to take a stroll at 5 p.m. in the garden of the Palais Royal. That's me, that you see all alone, meditating on a bench. I converse with myself on politics, love, taste, or philosophy. I abandon my mind to libertinism. I let it follow the first wise or foolish idea that turns up, the way one sees in the Allée des Fois our dissolute young men following the footsteps of a courtesan who has an airy manner, laughing face, lively eye, and turned-up nose, only to leave her for another, accosting all of them and attaching themselves to none. My thoughts. Those are my girlfriends. I converse with myself, he says. So even before the dialogue that he now engages in with Rameau, Diderot has already split himself into parts. It's like our childhood phrase, me, myself, and I. This is not the strenuous logical reasoning of the old rationalists like Descartes, who still, on the whole, held their authority in the intellectual culture of France at this time. Diderot is letting his thoughts wander freely, and, most important, he describes it as pleasurable. Remember, Samuel Johnson was afraid of letting his thoughts go free. Diderot calls them his girlfriends. He says he's behaving like a libertine, and that was the word which meant not just free love, but free thinking, free thought. Boswell chased ignobly after actual girls. Diderot has a sort of love affair with ideas. Rameau's Nephew is a very miscellaneous work. It's full of clever jabs at real people whom Diderot happened to dislike, all of whom are forgotten today. Because he's a very witty writer, some of that is still enjoyable to read, but I won't be going into any of that. In this lecture, I want to highlight two themes, and they'll both be very important in the other works we go on to read. The first, which we've already touched on, is the question of role-playing in society. The second is the difference between books and real life. And that theme will be the startling gap that appears, once people begin to see it that way, between the moral values that we hold dear and the aesthetic values that give us pleasure in works of imagination. First, then, the role-playing. Hume, of course, saw role-playing as the normal way we live our lives. And for him, that was apparently a perfectly comfortable thought. He liked playing the role of Le Bon David, the genial, gregarious, worldly philosopher. Diderot is suggesting something more disquieting, something closer to the uneasiness that Boswell sometimes experiences when he's pretending to be Captain MacHeath and is really just paying for the company of a couple of teenage prostitutes and pretending not to. What Rameau describes, always I mean Rameau the Nephew, not the composer, is a life of humiliating parasitism. He gives music lessons to rich people's kids, and then they let him dine at their luxurious tables, but only on condition that he say harmlessly clever things and never forget he's really little better than an employee. And Rameau describes one occasion where he got kicked out of a mansion for cracking a joke that was too close to the truth. He'd been asked to give up the place of honor to an abbé who was currently in favor. Abbé is a confusing term. It was a church sinecure for someone who might actually have no religious duties at all. And so Rameau says cheerfully, "That's fine for today, but tomorrow you'll take the next seat down, and so on, until finally you'll be next to me, a poor dull bugger like yourself, qui siedo sempre come un maestoso cazzo fra due coglioni." He's discreet enough to say it in Italian, but everyone knows he's saying a majestic phallus between two testicles, so they kick him out. But what comes through vividly is Rameau's self-contempt. He's made a successful career out of fawning on the rich, and he despises himself for it. At one point, he sarcastically reproaches himself for ever allowing himself to act like he's his own person. So he's addressing himself. He says, "How can you be so idiotic? Can't you flatter like others do? Couldn't you lie, swear, perjure yourself, promise, keep your promise, or renege on it like others? Can't you get down on all fours like others?" There's a memorable saying by the great Irish satirist Jonathan Swift. He says, climbing is performed in the same posture as creeping. That is, you see someone climbing up the ladder of success, but all you have to do is rotate it 90 degrees and they're crawling on all fours, which is just what Rameau is saying. So what's being tested in this dialogue is the problem of sincerity or authenticity at its very heart. The word hypocrite in Greek originally meant an actor. And in that sense, as Rameau acknowledges, he's a total hypocrite, role-playing all the time. But he challenges the moi, the Diderot character, to admit he too is a role-player who pretends he's not one. So not only is Rameau sincere in telling his real values or anti-values, but he also embodies the only kind of authenticity, according to him, that can really exist. Society makes the rules, degrading though the rules may be, he's willing to play by them. So he's trapped in the self-contempt of somebody who's figured it all out, but now he can only despise himself for it. Here's another of his descriptions of his lifestyle. He has to heap flattery on a rich actress who is extremely fat and absolutely talentless, but the mistress of a politician who makes sure the theaters keep giving her star roles. So Rameau says, item, she's meaner, prouder, and stupider than a goose. Item, she thinks she's witty. Item, you've got to persuade her that you think she's wittier than anyone. Item, she knows nothing, but she makes the decisions. Item, you've got to applaud her decisions with hands and feet. Jump for joy, go weak with admiration. But if Rameau is poisoned by his own self-contempt, the Diderot character in the dialogue is made very uneasy by what he's saying. What if everyone, even the great editor of the encyclopedia, is really just currying favor like Rameau? What if everyone, like Horace's slave said, is just a puppet jerking around when his strings are pulled? The Diderot character, the moi, does his best to argue for virtue and truth. But if it's really society that makes all the rules, why should you regard it as anything but a game you're trying to win? And of course, both characters, as I say, are aspects of Diderot himself. Try as he may, he can never silence this disturbing voice in his own head. Maybe virtue and truth are just conventions. Maybe you're a sucker if you really believe in them. So that's where this provisional, uncompleting book gets to with its picture of human life. Now for my other theme, the difference between real life and the imaginary world of art. The classical view was, art is supposed to reproduce life, hold the mirror up to nature, and also teach us moral insights by showing us not just how things are, but why they have to be that way. Because in classical theory, an accurate picture of the universe is automatically a moral, meaningful picture. But what if art is altogether different from life? And it was at just this moment in the history of our culture that the concept of the aesthetic began to develop. That is, a privileged, self-contained, separate realm of art. Before that time, nobody thought of the arts as a single phenomenon. But now, painting and music and poetry and dance were all being grouped together as the aesthetic, which was not then necessarily holding the mirror up to life, but maybe creating an alternative to life. And people began to realize that any written work is always at a considerable remove from what it describes. We saw that even James Boswell, sitting down the very day to record the details of his day accurately, he would still end up with an idealized version of his life more satisfying than the real one. And here's something else that began to develop at this time. Instead of thinking of an art as a craft or a skill, more or less impersonal, something you learn how to do, people began to glorify the artist as a special kind of genius who has a creative imagination that ordinary people don't. And this trend is closely related to something I mentioned in the very first lecture of the course. A new expressivist theory of art begins to see art as expressing, forcing out from within, a highly personal vision. And this change can be illustrated with a very well-known example. Music historians tell us that Mozart, unbelievably gifted though he was, thought of his music as a craft. He prolifically turned out scores for other musicians to play. Whereas Beethoven, only a generation later, liked to philosophize about questions of ultimate meaning, and Beethoven thought of his music as embodying a personal vision of truth. There's a lot about music in Rameau's Nephew, and Diderot is very modern in bringing out a contrast between talent and genius. Rameau the Nephew has a certain amount of talent, and the one thing he actually loves and believes in is music. But he knows he'll never be able to do anything much good, and he knows his hated uncle was a true genius whose music will live forever, as indeed it has. And at one point in the dialogue, Rameau gives a savagely unsympathetic portrait of that uncle, a man that Diderot knew personally and certainly didn't like. And Rameau says, if he ever did any good to anyone, it was without realizing it. He's a philosopher in his own way. He thinks of nothing but himself, and the rest of the universe isn't worth any more to him than a nail on a pair of bellows. His wife and his daughter can go ahead and die when they like, and as long as the church bell tolls for them in intervals of a 12th and a 17th, everything will be fine. That's lucky for him. That's what I admire in these men of genius. They're only good for one thing, and beyond that, nothing. Classical theory always claimed that a great artist necessarily had to be a good human being. This new concept of the aesthetic puts art off by itself, with its own internal beauty and coherence, and the power of genius that makes someone able to create great art is expressly distinguished from the qualities that make up a good person. The artist is supposed to create art, not necessarily moral truth. And it's not just the artist who's excused from ordinary moral standards. The work of art is set free from them. There's a wonderful remark by Simone Weil, the French religious philosopher writing at the time of World War II. She said memorably that whereas real goodness is endlessly varied and satisfying, goodness in fiction always tends to be boring. And whereas real evil is ugly and hateful, imaginary evil is somehow fascinating, so we want books and movies about villains and crooks. And this is a very important insight that we'll return to when we read Laclos' great novel, Les Liaisons Dangereuses. It's something that interests Diderot very much. He makes Rameau tell a whole series of stories about con men whose audacity and cleverness are very entertaining to hear about, and then the moi character reflects with some distress, I didn't know whether to stay or escape, laugh, or get indignant. I began to feel aggravated in the presence of a man who would talk about a horrible act, a hideous crime, the way a connoisseur of painting would examine the beauties of a work of art, or the way that a moralist or historian would bring out the circumstances of a heroic act. If we return with this perspective to the question of role-playing, we should note that among his other talents, Diderot was a successful playwright, and he wrote a short work called Paradox on the Actor, sur le comédien in French, that's become a classic of drama theory. In modern America, there's a strong tradition of method acting. The performer reaches down into his or her own emotional experience to find an equivalent for the role on the stage. The European tradition is very different. It teaches the best actors detach their personal feelings from the roles they play. This is the paradox that Diderot spells out. The actor, he says, has long listened to himself. The cries of his own grief are noted in his ear. The gestures of his despair come from memory and have been prepared before a mirror. The actor's tears descend from his brain. Those of the man of sensibility may rise from his heart. It's the feelings that disturb beyond measure the head of the man of sensibility. It's the actor's head that sometimes gives a passing disturbance to his feelings. He weeps like an unbelieving priest who preaches the passion, like a seducer on his knees before a woman he doesn't love but wants to deceive, like a beggar in the street who abuses you and he gives up hope of moving you, or like a courtesan who feels nothing but swoons in your arms. Some of the central issues of this course are there in a nutshell. Sensibility was supposed to be all about spontaneous, genuine emotion, but emotions can be simulated, and to do it well, it's better to not actually feel them too much yourself. The courtesan gives most satisfaction when she's faking pleasure. Remember Boswell. Similarly, the actor learns to use a mirror to see himself from the outside, which is very much the empiricist's take on what we should all do. If they'd had video recorders then, it would have been even better. So here's what we end up with. People in society are all actors, conning each other, flattering each other, playing their roles more or less well. And if they have any self-awareness at all, conscious of their own hollowness and inauthenticity. On the other hand, works of art are self-contained wholes, observing rules of their own. So Rameau the uncle can be a thoroughly hateful person in real life, but can compose immortal harmonies. And the conscious role-playing that seems so degrading in real life in Rameau the nephew becomes the perfection of art when a great actor does it on stage. The philosopher Hegel at the beginning of 19th century saw in Rameau's nephew the anxiety of modern self-consciousness floundering around, trying to find a basis of value when the old order is breaking down. The moi keeps asserting wisdom and truth. The lui, Rameau, just jeers at him and says the only truth we can find is the literally artificial truth of art. The wit of the Enlightenment, from Hegel's point of view, is a symptom of despair, and this unpublished work of Diderot represents the self-critique of that publicly confident movement.